The recent stoush between Scott Morrison and French President Emmanuel Macron has raised the profile of France in Australian media. But France is on the other side of the world, right? Well, actually, that's not quite true. France claims sovereignty over a group of Melanesian islands less than 1,500 kilometres from Brisbane, closer to the Queensland capital than Melbourne. New Caledonia in the South Pacific is part of the French Republic. It sends representatives to the French Parliament, uses a currency that's fixed to the value of the euro, and perhaps more importantly, hosts sections of the French Army, Navy, and Air Force. But the United Nations regards the islands as a non-self-governing territory, essentially a colony. And indigenous people there, known as Kanak, have been fighting for independence for decades. Their struggle led to the 1998 framework agreement known as the Noumea Accord, which conceded up to three referendums to decide whether New Caledonia should become independent. France has now announced that the third referendum will take place on the 12th of December, angering independence parties which have called for a delay until late 2022. So the stakes are high. To explain what's going on, I'm talking today with Nick McClellan. Nick is a journalist and activist who's worked in the Pacific region since 1986 with not-for-profits and the ABC. He's the winner of the 2020 Sean Dorney Grant for Pacific Journalism and reports for Ireland's Business Magazine, Inside Story, The Guardian, and others. You're listening to The Sound of Solidarity, brought to you by Solidarity. We're a revolutionary socialist group in Australia, and if you'd like to find out more about us, our website is solidarity.net.au. I'm David Glanz, and I'm recording this episode on unceded Wurundjeri land in Naam, or Melbourne. So, Nick, welcome.
Hello, David.
Look, it's a big question, but first up, for people who are new to the politics of New Caledonia, can you give us a brief overview of the struggle for independence so far?
New Caledonia has gone through a colonial process in some ways very similar to Australia. The indigenous Kanak people, the Melanesian people, were colonised in 1853. It was a prison colony originally. Indeed, people from the Paris Commune of 1871 were deported to New Caledonia, including the famous revolutionary Louise Michel. Later, in the 1890s and beyond, there were free settlers arriving to take the land, particularly on the fertile west coast of the main island. And at the turn of the century, people discovered nickel. And New Caledonia has extensive reserves of nickel, a crucial strategic metal. The Kanak population resisted this process of colonization, of settlement, of the theft of land right from the beginning. There were major revolts in 1878, 1917. And so today's Kanak nationalist movement harks back to those earlier revolts by Kanak chiefs and supporters. Most recently, there were violent clashes in the mid-1980s, particularly between 1984 and 1988. And a National Liberation Front, the FLNKS, the Kanak Socialist National Liberation Front, took up the mobilisation to halt elections and a referendum at that time, and called not for greater autonomy within France, but full sovereign independence. Those violent conflicts, which saw clashes between the Kanak movement, armed settlers in the right-wing fascist groups, and the French army, ended in a series of violent conflicts in 1988, which led to a number of peace agreements. And the most important of those, a decade later in 1998, is called the Noumea Accord. And that set the country on a path to a referendum or a series of referendums on its political status. And that's where we're up to today.
We'll come back to the referendum question in a moment, because obviously that's at the centre of things at the moment. But the Kanak movement is a movement against colonisation. Could you place it in its broader context with other indigenous movements in the region, including here in Australia?
There are political parties in New Caledonia that date back to after the Second World War. French communists started organising in the Kanak tribe. lives after the war, and returning servicemen from the European battlefields got involved in political activity, a major party, Union Caledonienne, was created in 1954. But more recently, in the 70s, the CONAC movement began building links with neighbouring French dependencies in the Pacific. So in those days, the late 70s, PNG had moved to independence in 1975. Timor was invaded, similarly, in 1975. The National Party in the New Hebrides, a British-French condominium, created the Vanuatu Party and led to independence in 1980. So it was a time of incredible ferment. And the CONAC movement built links with these neighbouring political movements, also with people in French Polynesia, another French dependency in the Eastern Pacific, famous, of course, for French nuclear testing at Mururoa, Fangataufa Atolls. And so there have been strong links going back to the 20th century between indigenous rights movements, including the Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander movement in Australia. More recently, the FLNKS, as a national liberation organisation, has built links with neighbouring Melanesian states. And so the independence movement is a full member of the Melanesian Spearhead Group, which is a sub-regional organisation that links together Papua New Guinea, Solomon Islands, Fiji, Vanuatu, and New Caledonia's CONAC movement. And that shows that there's a real attempt to integrate New Caledonia into its regional environment rather than see it as part of France, you know, a little bit of France on the other side of the world.
Yes, and that support is potentially very significant, as you've actually reported very recently. The Melanesian Spearhead Group and some of the other neighbouring countries that you mentioned there have come out against the holding of the referendum in December and have called, like the CONAC movement, for its postponement. Now, I mentioned early on that the Noumea Accord allowed for three referendums. This is actually the final one of the three. So the yes vote lost in the first two votes, but there was a clear improvement in the yes vote between the first referendum and the second referendum. So this referendum was really, really important. So the French decision has been described by senior independence party leaders as resembling a declaration of war against the CONAC people. And they're calling on people not to vote and have indicated they will contest the result. So why have the French decided to press on? Why do the CONACs want it postponed? And where is all this heading?
Yeah, look, it comes at the end of the culmination of a long transition since the Noumea Accord was first negotiated back in 1998, so more than 20 years ago. The idea of the Noumea Accord was to put off a decision on political status and get supporters and opponents of independence working together. So new political institutions were created. France bankrolled certain affirmative action programs, and powers were transferred from Paris to Noumea, the capital of New Caledonia. So the local government, the local congress, local provincial assemblies get control over things like health and education. So teachers have been rewriting the curriculum to reflect the regional realities that New Caledonia is part of the Pacific, not a neighbour of Germany. And so there's been a lot of work. The final unique element of this transition was that there were three, not one, referenda to determine the political status. People were asked to vote yes or no whether New Caledonia should stay as part of the French Republic or become a fully independent and sovereign country. And the first vote in November 2018, where I reported as a journalist, they did much better, the independence movement that people were expecting. Predictions were they'd only get 30% support. In fact, they got 43% in the first referendum. The second referendum, which was held in October last year, they got to 47%, a bit more than 47%. So there was clear momentum behind the independence campaign. There was growing dialogue with members of the other ethnic communities. You know, the indigenous CONAC people, because of migration and settlement, only make up about 40% of the population. So to win, they had to get support from people who migrated from Wallis and Futuna, French Polynesia, Vanuatu, other French dependencies in the region, from the European community, large European community in Noumea, the capital. And the feeling was that the momentum of going from 43 to 47 would carry on to the third vote. However, the French government has changed. A new government under Prime Minister Jean Castex came in earlier this year, and instead of negotiating an agreed date for the referendum, they unilaterally set the date in the middle of this year, saying it would be on the 12th of December, the final crucial poll about whether New Caledonia will be independent. CONAC leaders, however, have said that there should be a deferral, particularly because there's been a massive surge of COVID-19 starting in early September. More than 11,300 people have been infected with coronavirus. That's a large number in a country of only 280,000 people. There's been hundreds of deaths, and that's a particular burden because the toll has fallen disproportionately on CONAC and other islanders, Tahitians, Wallisians, who are the poorer members of the community, have less access to healthcare, have less housing, and so on. So the CONAC leaders have said, let's postpone the vote until next year, till after the French presidential elections, where Macron is being re-elected, he believes, in April. But France has refused, and France is rushing ahead with this vote, despite both local political leaders calling for a delay and indeed growing support around the region for that call.
So why is France rushing this vote? And by the way, I note on the side that the French Prime Minister, who's forcing through the 12th of December date, himself has just tested positive to COVID, so he should have a little bit more sympathy. Why is France rushing this vote? Why is it so important for them to get the vote now and, presumably from their point of view, to kill off the independence movement?
It's a combination of those two elements. One, there's a hope that there can be a strategic defeat for the FLNKS and for other pro-independence forces outside this coalition, and the belief that if they lose the third referendum, then France can basically rip up the Namur Accord. It's much more complex than that because this agreement is entrenched in the French constitution, but there's a belief that the CONAC movement will give up. I think that's a mistaken belief on the part of the French state. But it comes at a particular geopolitical context, and as we know, there's growing tensions between the United States and China within what's been dubbed the Indo-Pacific region. And in recent years, French President Emmanuel Macron has made a big show about France's possible contribution to the Western alliance, which is seeking to contain China's rising economic and political influence. In May 2018, Macron came and spoke in an Australian warship, gave him in Sydney Harbour under the prime ministership of Malcolm Turnbull, and talked about creating an India-Australia-France axis in the Pacific. Part of that's based on arms sales, the proposal that the French corporation Naval Group would build submarines for Australia, that France would sell Rafale fighters to India, and that New Caledonia, with its military facilities, would be a pivot in France's presence in the Indo-Pacific region. Fast forward to more recent events, the United States has made a strategic decision that France really doesn't bring much firepower militarily to the challenge of rising Chinese power. And they've seen Australia as a more suitable piece of real estate for enhanced strategic cooperation. And so Scott Morrison and his government ripped up a $90 billion contract with the French corporation. But more than the money, that's put a blow in France's strategic vision that it is a major power in the Pacific. And last week, I interviewed Pierre-Chanel Tuttugoro, who's Secretary General of Union Caledonienne, which is the our largest pro-independence party. And Tuttugoro suggested, questioned whether this sort of show of force, this sense that we're going ahead with the referendum regardless, is not just a signal to the CONAC movement and other supporters of independence, but it's also a signal to Australia, New Zealand, and the Americans that France wants to be an Indo-Pacific power. And so the geopolitics of this overlay the long-running quest for independence from the independence movement, particularly the CONAC movement in New Caledonia.
I've been wondering about that myself because the new agreement between Australia, the US and the UK, which is known as AUKUS, which Morrison announced, really surprising everybody, just a month or two ago, is very much part of consolidating the English-speaking world in a form of alliance clearly aimed at China. So does that mean for Paris that their position in the Pacific becomes more important or less important? Is this a time for them to accept that they're not imperialist players in the Pacific, or is this a time for them to step up their position? Because I mentioned there are military bases in New Caledonia. That presumably allows France to project substantial military power across a wide part of the Pacific. So what's the strategic thinking for the French ruling class?
The French actually don't have many military assets in the region. They have a couple of aging frigates, they have some helicopters and patrol boats. Those military assets have played an important role in things like monitoring the strategic exclusive economic zone under the law of the sea, tracking down fisheries and violations and so on. But in terms of the bigger picture, you know, the presence in Australia, for example, of US Marine deployments in the Northern Territory, the possibility that US and British submarines through AUKUS will now use Stirling Naval Base just outside of Fremantle in Western Australia as a place for forward deployment into the region. These are more crucial assets that really French Polynesia, New Caledonia, which are further out of the way, can't play the same role. I think it's also that AUKUS is a much broader agenda than simply submarines and nuclear submarines. It's about a much wider network of technology transfers, including preparations for cyber warfare, the use of artificial intelligence, and so on. And there's a lot of, frankly, competition between American and European Union corporations in these spheres. You know, there are capitalist contradictions between the major powers where the European Union is under pressure through NATO to play a greater role in global defence. But France has been wanting to present itself as a major power, given it has overseas dependencies in every ocean of the world. But I think there's a recognition that France has a lot of internal disputes. And, you know, all of this is being played out in the lead up to the French presidential elections, which begin in April. Also, the legislative elections for the French National Assembly, which follow by June next year. A lot of this is political theatre, as much as broader strategic thinking, with Macron facing a challenge from extreme right parties like Marine Le Pen's Rassemblement National and a new neo-fascist named Eric Zemmour, who's pushing really extreme right-wing policies into the presidential debate. So for Macron, there's a certain crude party political interest in showing how tough he is. And that's one of the reasons I believe that the current Castex government and overseas minister Sébastien Lecornu are moving ahead with this referendum, despite the clear danger that if the independence movement does participate and many CNAC voters don't turn out, that there's a great danger that this vote will not be credible in the international community.
So you've mentioned that the challenge around independence is a challenge to Macron's standing, to France's imperialist ambitions in the Pacific, and is a factor in the upcoming elections. What are the economic factors at play as well? I mean, the obvious question is, who owns the nickel and who's making the money out of that? But presumably there are other economic assets as well.
Nickel is the key industry in New Caledonia. It's the major source of export earnings. And paradoxically in this discussion, the greatest market for exports of the raw nickel ore is China. And that's been a battle that's played out. A crucial part of the independence struggle has been to get control of key sectors of the nickel industry, both in terms of mining and smelting the raw ore into nickel metal, which has, you know, a whole range of strategic implications, everything from managing manufacturing pots and pans to spaceships and armaments and so on. It's a very important resource on a global scale. One of the key successes of the Namir Accord transition was that the northern province, which is dominated by pro-independence parties and has been for the last 30 years, negotiated with a series of transnational corporations to build a major nickel smelter at Koniambo in the northern province. And that exporting nickel, not just to traditional partners like Australia and Japan, but to Korea and China. And indeed, the Northern Province, through its development arm, has joint venture companies operating in Korea, South Korea, and in China. It's unprecedented in China for such a sort of foreign investment venture. And that's broken that stranglehold that France has had over the smelting of nickel through Eramet Corporation, which has a local subsidiary that runs a nickel smelter in Noumea. And Eramet has a strategic investment from the French state. So this has been a battle played out over recent years about who controls this key resource and which markets it's done. And there's been a shift towards Asian markets, particularly Korea and China, as part of the independence struggle.
The referendum is intended to be actually less than 3 weeks from this conversation. It's remarkably close. Can the Kanak movement carry off a boycott movement that is sufficiently united and strong that it makes the referendum, if it goes ahead, clearly null and void? And is the movement strong enough to force a fourth and further referendum from the French? So a little bit of crystal ball gazing about how you think the struggle is going to unfold over the next few months and perhaps even the next few years.
As a journalist, I'm always wary of crystal ball gazing because on enough occasions I've been wrong. It's also very difficult. I haven't been back to New Caledonia this year because of the COVID restrictions, so it's very difficult to get a sense of what's going on the ground. It was interesting, though, I was there in 2018 for 6 weeks reporting on the referendum and spent a lot of time not just in the capital, Noumea, talking with pundits and politicians, but going out to rural areas and talking to ordinary people on the ground and getting a sense. And I came back to Noumea believing that, you know, the polls, which said that the independence movement would get 30% support, the pundits at that time, the media common sense, was wrong. And that was the case. Many people were shocked and surprised that the Kanak movement got 43%, not 30%, as was widely predicted. I think you'll find the same thing on the ground now. But in this case, the independence movement is calling for non-participation in the referendum on the 12th of December. They haven't called for an active boycott, and that's a sort of code word in the past for active protests that would essentially shut down the whole operation. During the clashes of 1984 to 1988, people literally went and smashed up ballot boxes, shut down town halls where the voting took place and so on. And that's not what's being proposed by key leaders at the moment. Rather, they're saying the previous two referenda in 2018-2020 had a massive turnout, over 80%, 86% for the second referendum. Now, that's unprecedented for elections in France where voting's not compulsory. I think you'll see this time that most people who support independence won't turn up. Some will for various reasons, but there's been a rare unanimity of all the diverse parties that make up the Kanak nationalist movement calling for non-participation. That includes bodies like the Kanak Customary Senate, which is an advisory body to the parliament, where Kanak chiefs, quite conservative chiefs, participate, through to the Labour Party, which is based on the Kanak trade union movement and is a very radical left-wing party, from quite conservative customary leaders to the trade union activists of the USTKE, everyone's saying, don't vote. And so I think you'll see a massive fall in turnout, particularly in the Northern Province and the Loyalty Islands Province, two of the three provinces where the Kanaks are the majority. I think other communities are weighing up this call, so I think the turnout will be lower, and I think this is a challenge for France because neighbouring Pacific countries are now speaking out and worrying about whether this will be a fair, credible and transparent vote. The government of Vanuatu under Prime Minister Bob Loughman has said that they support the call for deferral, and just in the last week we've had what's called the Pacific Elders' Voice, a group of former presidents and prime ministers, respected political figures around the region, who've written to President Macron saying that this vote should be delayed because of the disruption of campaigning caused by the recent surge of COVID. So you're seeing major figures, former president of Kiribati and Otitong, former prime minister of Tuvalu, Nelly Sopoanga, the outgoing Secretary General of the Pacific Islands Forum as well, Dame Meg Taylor of Papua New Guinea, have all called on France to take a step back from the confrontation that they're creating. countries like Fiji and Papua New Guinea are members of the UN Special Committee on Decolonization, given they're calling for a delay, I think that they will use that UN tribune to raise international awareness that this is not a free vote. What happens next is in the wind. I interviewed a leader, Victor Tutugoro from the UPM, pro-independence party. He said if the vote goes ahead on the 12th, we won't be there on the 13th to negotiate. And I think there may be a period of some months until people wait and see what happens with the French presidential election. The Kanak movement ultimately may want to negotiate with a new incoming president, Macron, and then the new government elected in mid-2022. So I think we're going to see some months of argy-bargy before there's discussion about what happens next. But I believe the Kanak movement is strong. I believe that they will want to continue with the quest for independence, having got so close. And I think we're going to see a standoff for some months until the politics of 2022 are resolved.
Now, I suspect Macron doesn't care very much about what Scott Morrison has to say, but nonetheless, I think we should establish what the Australian government's view is on this situation. Is it for independence? Is it neutral? How is its relationship with France, fractured as it is at the moment, playing out in this scenario?
Well, the official stated position of the Australian government is that this is a matter for New Caledonians, that both supporters and opponents of independence must come together and determine the future of their country, the so-called common destiny, together. They have publicly stated they see France as a neutral umpire in some ways between these contending forces on the ground in New Caledonia. But that's, of course, nonsense. For a long time, Australia and France have been developing an extended strategic partnership in the region related, as I said earlier, to the US-China tensions and the attempts to rebuild a Western alliance in the face of rising Chinese influence. This began under Kevin Rudd. This is a bipartisan policy where Rudd signed an agreement with the French government back in previous decades. That's continued through the Turnbull administration, where Turnbull expanded this with a vision statement that Julie Bishop negotiated, and with agreements when Macron came to Sydney in 2018, then on with the Morrison government. The centrepiece of this was the submarine contract, where the French corporation Naval Group, previously a state-owned enterprise, would be building these submarines in partnership with companies in Australia. But it involved a whole range of activities around joint military operations, around trying to bring France into regional activities, the Quad and links with India. France was seen as a crucial player by successive Labor governments and Liberal governments. That's been blown up to a certain extent, and there's behind the scenes quite a lot of scrabbling going on in an attempt to rebuild the relationship that people in the Australian state have been eager to maintain. I suspect once again that not only will we have to wait to see what happens with the French presidential elections, we're going to have to wait and see what will happen with the Australian elections. But I believe that Penny Wong and Richard Miles and other key members of the Australian Labor Party also support this strategic partnership with France in the region, and they'll be looking to smooth over the troubled waters that have been created when President Macron called the Prime Minister a liar. Listening to Penny Wong, Richard Miles and others speak from the Labor Party, they see this as bad diplomacy rather than a bad direction to build a partnership with France. But our neighbours in the Pacific are much more wary of this, and so you have the Melanesia Spearhead Group companies, but wider than that, these leaders from Polynesia, Micronesia, across the region, very critical of France's role, that it's not accepting that the Namir Accord process is a decolonisation process. And under international law, the colonised people, the Kanak people, have a right to self-determination. The UN jargon is that there is an innate and active right to self-determination. Kanaks have tried to do that with people from other communities, Wallisian, Tahitian, European, and so on, through this Noumea Accord transition, working together. But their attitude, speaking to Daniel Goa, the FLNKS spokesman, he said to me, listen, we have to negotiate with France as the administering power, the colonial power, rather than the right-wing politicians in Noumea, who are France's key party supporters. And so I think we're going to see that the independence movement, once this referendum's out of the way, will be wanting to talk to Paris. And they'll be looking for local and regional support to put France to the negotiating table to sort out the path forward. Will Australia play a role in that? I think, unfortunately, this issue is largely invisible in the Australian media. You know, people have been in the Australian media have been happy to talk about the France Morrison spat, but they're not looking at the broader strategic questions about nickel mining, about resources, about strategic deployments that underline this crisis that's brewing just off the coast of Queensland.
No, well, thank you for that. And while official politics in Australia is silent or worse on this issue, many of us on the left are in support of the CANAC movement for self-determination and national liberation, and also opposed to the new military agreement, AUKUS, and the development of nuclear submarines for the Australian Navy, recognising that this is all part of one big fight against war and inequality and colonisation. And ironically, the day before the referendum will be pushed through on the 12th of December, here in Melbourne on the 11th at 1 o'clock at the State Library, we will be gathering to protest against the nuclear submarine programme, against the AUKUS agreement, and the anti-war movement is beginning to stir, and I'm sure there will be many sympathisers for the CANAC cause in that movement. So thank you, Nick. You have been incredibly clear, very, very helpful, and I really appreciate your time.
Thanks very much for taking the time to talk. And it's an important issue for Australia and Australians. You know, our engagement with the Pacific around nuclear issues, around climate issues, but most importantly about self-determination and political independence is a key issue, because there are parallels with Bougainville, with the struggling West Papua. What's happening in New Caledonia is part of a movement right across the Melanesian region and further abroad with French Polynesia and other places seeking to end 20th century colonialism, but address the environmental, the political, the social legacies of that time. So thanks for the chance to talk about it with you.
Thank you, and I couldn't agree more.